You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
All right, to the phone lines, and Mike's up first. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, sir.
Oh, happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there that celebrated today.
Absolutely.
I was by your shop Thursday.
Okay.
And looking at your spindle head soap.
Right.
And I was trying to remember if I'd heard you mention that, like, you had another type of spindle head or some other type of insecticidal soap besides that one.
All three. We have straight spindle head, we have straight insecticidal soap, and then they came out a couple of years ago with a ready-to-use sprayer with the a little hand sprayer with the spinosad soap combination. And then this year they came out with a concentrate for folks who have discovered how well it works and want to spray a bigger area. Now, like anything, even though this is a totally safe and natural product, spinosad is somewhat toxic to bees, so I recommend using it only in the areas where you're having a problem. But spinosad is very effective against caterpillars. It's one of the few things that I've found that's fairly effective against stink bugs. So it's just a combination of two products, but I think you call it synergistic. The two products together work better than using the two halves of it separately.
Okay, then that's the one I ended up getting, the concentrate.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I wasn't sure, you know, because I saw you had this other one called Safer or something like that.
Well, if you were just fighting aphids, I'd probably go with Safers. In some cases where you don't want to use a BT product for concern of other caterpillars, where you just need an instant kill on caterpillars that you see sitting there munching on your bougainvilleas or your beans, I might just go with straight spinosad. But for most uses, and, you know, you're simply getting the benefit of two safe and effective products at the same time.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Bob. Appreciate all your help.
Well, it's always a pleasure having the opportunity to explain things a bit. Mike, you get out, and hope all the ladies in your family have a happy Mother's Day as well. And I'll move on to Robert. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, sir.
I have heard several conversations this weekend and previous about people who are a little bit intimidated by sprayers, which I think most of us are.
Yeah.
I mean, just trying to keep these things running is a full-time job. But anyway, I found a way to distribute live nematodes that is really simple and makes the application an even application easier.
Please share.
And that's to take 2 5-gallon buckets, like a Home Depot bucket or a chlorine bucket or something, tablet bucket. Fill them half full of water, cut the sponge in half, and put one in each bucket and get it emptied. You know,
yeah, and when you look at that sponge, realize, of course, that the nematodes are not evenly distributed through the sponge. You'll see that little dab of goo. Make your cut kind of right in the middle of that, so you got about half the goo, so to speak, on each side, because if you just whack off the piece of the blue sponge without being careful where you're cutting, you might end up still have all of them on one piece and none of them on the other piece. But yeah, I'm with you so far.
Yeah, thank you. That's important, and I just sort of jumped right over that, and probably would have forgotten it. But anyway, you've got 2 2.5-gallon buckets now,
right?
And with all the nematodes off the sponge, and then you fill the both buckets to the 5 gallon and basically divide the yard into halves.
Okay.
And then just take a smaller container to fill your watering can.
Right.
And literally just walk up and down one half, just kind of slinging it, if you will, out wide, and just go back and forth until you've used up that entire five gallons on that half, and then you go to the other half. But it gives you a chance to kind of see how you're doing in terms of distribution, and it really is a very simple way to do it.
And you get some exercise at the same time.
A little bit. Yeah, I was just about to say, and choose a watering can that's suitable for your strength. I mean, it's not a big challenge, but if I can do it.
Well, don't sell yourself short. The one thing I would tell you about that is you can't take a break in the middle of it, because nematodes stay in the water too long. They will drown. So you don't do one bucket and then go have a cold drink and then go back and do the other bucket. You need to pretty much do it in one continuous operation. But, hey, that's a perfect solution for the person that's not trying to do 2 acres.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's just for what it's worth, and I hope that makes it easier for some people who just would rather not face a hose-end sprayer or anything else.
I appreciate the suggestion. On the subject of sprayers, now, they unfortunately don't make a hose-end sprayer yet, but I've been experimenting for about 3 months now with a new line of sprayers by a company called Centurion, C-E-N-T-U-R-I-O-N, I believe it is.
Yeah, and I remember hearing you mention it.
Yeah, they sure make a good sprayer at a better price than Gilmore and some of these others. And I've been real pleased with that sprayer. But like I say, unfortunately, they don't make a hose-in sprayer. But anybody that's out there looking for a little pump-up sprayer, anything from a half gallon to 2 gallons, that's the sprayer at this point that I'm saying is the best one on the market.
Bob, thank you very much. Always good to talk to you, and I'll probably talk to you again soon about Levi.
I will look forward to that, and happy Mother's Day to Susie.
I'll tell her.
Thanks, Robert. Bye.
Best to you.
You too. Bye. All right, let's see here. Things have shifted around a little bit. Next up is Teresa, going by the how long people have been on hold. Teresa and then Barbara and Jeff. Good morning, Teresa.
Oh, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question about some grass. It is St. Augustine grass under a live oak, so you're going to say, that's probably why it doesn't grow there. Some of the runners are under the tree, and the rest of the yard looks beautiful, but I don't know if it's a disease, I don't know if it's an insect, but I've tried extra organic fertilizer there. Last year I put beneficial nematodes, but I don't know what the problem is. It just doesn't grow.
Well, fertilizer is not energy. Fertilizer is raw materials. Fertilizer is food, but food doesn't do a darn thing for you unless you have a stomach to digest it and give you the benefit of the food. That's kind of the way it is with grass and things like that and fertilizer. Just fertilizer doesn't help your plants unless you've got the sun's energy to allow the plants to process things. And anytime you've got a shady area, anytime you've got anything, whether it's your home, whether it's a big tree, whether it's an arbor or anything else, anything that blocks the sun is going to cut down on the amount of energy the grass receives. And St. Augustine is our most shade-tolerant grass, but all the fertilizer in the world isn't going to do any good at all unless you have enough sunlight. And big oak trees tend to, just shade it out enough that the grass is much thinner, and if they get too thick, you don't get any growth at all. The two solutions are, the one that I don't like would be to have an arborist thin your trees and get more light through, in which case your grass would grow better. I think you're better off just to either plant a shade-tolerant ground cover like English ivy or Asiatic jasmine, or maybe create a little shade garden underneath that tree with variegated ginger and holly fern and akubas and shrimp plant and all those things that will grow in the shade. But it's just a losing battle, and it's not lack of fertilizer or anything else, just lack of light. And unless you can find a way to get more light to that grass, it's always going to be thin and not nearly as pretty as it is out in the sunny area.
So you said English ivy, Asiatic. So, I mean, you started rattling them off. Couldn't write that down.
Well, if you want ground covers, their Asiatic jasmine is very common because it is so successful. English ivy and Algerian ivy are two other types of ground covers that grow in the shade. There is another ground cover called Vinca, V-I-N-C-A. This is not the periwinkles with bright flowers. Vinca minor has lavender flowers and delicate green leaves, and it will make a pretty ground cover in the shade. And finally, there is a plant with a misleading name. It's called dwarf plumbago, but it's really not a plumbago at all. It's not even related to plumbago. It's just that the flowers look like plumbago. Now, it goes away in the winter months, but it comes back vigorously in the spring, and it makes a pretty little low green ground cover. So those are all things, Asiatic jasmine, English ivy, Vinca minor, dwarf plumbago. Those are all ground covers that would be much happier underneath that big oak tree than your grass will.
It's interesting that in the backyard there's four oak trees and the grass grows just fine under those.
Well, the canopies may be higher. If you had a light,
the canopy's higher in the front yard, so that's kind of strange.
Well,
I don't know how that happened.
Well, if you could get out there with a light meter, you could get a better idea of, and of course, you know, it may be that the ones in the backyard get that bright shade for 8 hours, the ones in front only for 4 hours. They're just, I've seen it 10,000 times if I've seen it once, but there are other possibilities. Sometimes the soil is thinner there and you'd have to water more often, but I tell you, 99 out of 100 times, it's a light issue. But
I didn't hear you say anything about plants and shade grass. I haven't tried that, but I know you're going to talk about ground covers. But you're always talking about shade grass, too.
And St. Augustine is our most shade-tolerant grass. You're totally wasting your time to try to grow Bermuda or Zoysia or any of those grasses. But if you want something that looks more like grass, you could plant dwarf monkey grass. It's dark green. Looks like grass. It's a little bit slow to grow and spread, but it's a beautiful ground cover in the shade. It just takes a while to fill in.
What'd you call it?
Dwarf monkey grass.
Oh, okay.
Properly, it's called Ophiopogon, but everybody knows it as monkey grass. The taller monkey grass would be fine if you want a ground cover that's a foot tall, but if you want something that's only 2 or 3 feet tall, 2 or 3 inches tall, the dwarf monkey grass would be still another ground cover you could consider, Teresa.
And here I thought it was going to be a disease or
no.
An insect and outside nematodes and all kind of things. Maybe it was.
I wish it were that easy because those are problems we could fix. This is a problem that as long as you have that beautiful oak tree, you're going to have the problem. So not quite that easy, but at least you're not out there spraying or, you know, sprinkling stuff.
Well, as long as I want to try something else, I think I'd be happy just trying anything else. Whatever I tried didn't work, so this is great.
Well, I appreciate it, and I hope you have a wonderful Mother's Day.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Bye. All right, now it's Barbara, Jeff, and Sandy, and Phyllis, and we get started with Barbara. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a Chinese tallow tree that my neighbor gave me.
Okay.
And God, it's done, you know, it's small, but it's done well for 3 years. And
mm-hmm.
then, you know, it didn't get watered enough this past summer, I guess.
Right.
And I thought it was dead. It was only like probably 4 feet, 3-4 feet high. So I thought, okay, well, it's gone. But now the bottom of it are shooting up all these little, you know, these new little leaves.
Right.
You know, so Should I just pull it out of the ground, or would that take? Would it turn into a new tree?
Well, it can turn into a new tree. If you are not going to be able to provide water for it in the future, then it's not a good tree for you because Chinese tallow, and my old friend Alton Grimm taught me that no plant is perfect. Every one of them has some good points and some bad points. The good points about Chinese tallow, it's fast growing. It does provide some food for the birds. It probably gives us better foliage color in the fall than almost any tree other than the red oak out there. The Chinese tallow has an absolutely gorgeous red to yellow fall color to it.
Right.
So those are the good points. Bad points are
there are a whole bunch of sprouts coming up. So well, do I just like let them go or clip them off?
You're going to clip off all except the strongest one.
Okay.
But the bad points are...
That may actually turn back into a tree.
Yes, it will turn back into a tree. Get it, you know, get one coming from not off the roots, but right at the base of it. Now, some people don't like them because I wouldn't recommend them out in the country because those seeds can get spread around. They can become a little bit invasive. And, my former mother-in-law had one in her yard, and like every time there was a wind, you're out raking up these little twigs because it's forever dropping just little dead twigs. That's just the way it grows. I have a couple of them growing along my creek that are absolutely beautiful, but same way, I pick up limbs out of them fairly regularly. So if you like the tree, if you like the fall color, by all means, one of those little, you let it, we call it a central leader or a trunk. Cut away all except the strongest one, keep it watered,
okay.
And it will grow back into a tree, but it's not the perfect tree.
Should I cut it away now or wait?
Yes, yes. Don't let the tree waste its time putting energy into things that you're going to be cutting off eventually. I would cut away all except the one. You might even think about putting a little cage, like a tomato cage or something around it, so it doesn't actually get broken off or mowed over. But
what about the original trunk?
If the original trunk is not sprouted by now, it's probably not going to.
Okay. All right. I will do it. Thank you.
Okay. And once again, happy Mother's Day. Jeff is up next. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Bob. Great show again.
Well, thank you, sir.
I got a bunch of cut ants. Use spinosad as a mound drench and also the orange oil and molasses mound drench. And I heard you talk one time about using sulfur.
Yep. It's if they are truly cut ants, and you probably know what you're looking at. Some people confuse the red harvester ant with the cut ant, which is that black ant that just strips the leaves off everything. Harvester ants go more for dead material and grain and things. But
this is stripping one of my trees, and
yep.
it's got a line probably... of ants, probably, I would say, 200 feet. Maybe.
Okay. Well, here's the deal, and here's the information you need to understand what you're trying to accomplish, and that is the ants don't actually eat the leaves. They're carrying those pieces of leaves down, putting them in that underground burrow, and the ant is actually living, eating a fungus that grows on the leaves. So if you know where the mound is, you go out and you get what's called wettable sulfur. It'll be called 50W, which stands for 50% wettable. And you spread maybe 5 pounds of sulfur, just sprinkle it all around over the top. And it may be 6 feet across where you see this mound that will have multiple entrances coming out. As it either gets watered or gets rain, it carries the sulfur down into the chamber, into the colony underneath, and sulfur is a natural fungicide. It kills off the fungus that the ants are eating, and then the colony dies out. May take a little time, but it is at least 80% of the time it's the most effective way I have found to totally kill out the colony. Now, here's what I want you to do in the meantime, and that is go to a good nursery, or I guess you could probably get it online. You're looking for a product called Tanglefoot. Comes in what looks like a little cottage cheese container, and this is the thickest, stickiest stuff. I mean, it makes axle grease look like hand lotion. But what you do is, with your tree that they are stripping, wrap either a piece of aluminum foil or a piece of plastic wrap of some sort around it, because you don't want to put your Tanglefoot directly on the bark. It can cause some deformities in the bark. But you wrap that trunk with foil or plastic or something, and then take like a tongue depressor or something like that and just smear about a 2-inch wide band of Tanglefoot all the way around the trunk, and the ants cannot cross it. If you just make a little narrow band, they'll just throw one of their buddies on top of it and walk across his back to get up and steal the leaves. But if you make it about a 2-inch wide band, The ants simply cannot get across it, and they will not be able to take the leaves off your tree. That's a good temporary solution. With a tree, it works. With a rose bush, not so well. With begonias, not so well. But a tree is pretty easy to protect. So I get some tanglefoot while I'm waiting for the sulfur to take the colony out.
Got you. And why didn't the, isn't that the idea of the molasses? Isn't that molasses supposed to kill the fungus also?
No, molasses stimulates all sorts of beneficial bacteria. And with fire ants and things like that, it stimulates bacteria that kill the ants. But in this case, they're not as susceptible to that kind of bacterial infection. And it's a lot harder to really get it spread adequately through there. They just build a totally different kind of mound or chamber than the fire ant does. That's a great way to kill fire ants, great way to kill carpenter ants. But there are, you know, thousands of kinds of ants
and
out
the
there.
The spinosad doesn't really affect them. I mean, I've made them move their mound.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Well, the spinosad, if you get it on them, the spinosad's going to kill 1,000 ants. Problem is there are 2,000 ants out there.
Right.
It's just
all
if
right.
you could get
well,
spinosad.
Information.
Yeah, if you get spinosad on every one of them, spinosad is a very good ant killer. But for every ant you see, there are 10 more of them hiding underground. And it's just, you know, it is asking one company of soldiers to take out a whole battalion of the enemy, and just not going to work that way, even if they're Marines.
Any idea on the wettable sulfur? Where would I get it?
Any hardware store and probably any nursery.
Okay. All right. Appreciate the information. Thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure, Jeff. Appreciate the call. Let's go ahead and talk to Sandy. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
How are you this morning? It's a beautiful day.
It is a gorgeous day out there. We deserve it.
I have been given for Mother's Day some beautiful bulbs that are called Christmas caladiums.
Okay.
Tell me how to plant them.
Okay, it's just now time. It's actually a variety is probably called White Christmas, and they're a beautiful white leaf with bright red veins, and they're just absolutely gorgeous.
When do they grow in the shade?
Yes, they do. They are strictly, they're what we call a fancy leaf caladium, so they'll take shade or morning sun. You do not want to plant them in the hot sun, but shade or morning sun is fine. You want to plant the bulbs about 3/4 to an inch deep.
Now, is that below my mulch or below the dirt?
Pull the mulch back and leave the mulch pull back until the bulbs, until they've sprouted and are up and growing. Pull the mulch back, and then about 3/4 inch, the top of the bulb should be about 3/4 inch down in the dirt proper.
Okay, and which end goes in the bottom?
Okay, your caladium bulb is going to be more of a flat bulb than a round bulb.
Yes.
And you will normally see like little projections sticking up from one side or the other, and the other side's going to be relatively smooth, even though it may be kind of gnarly looking, but it'll be fairly smooth, whereas the one side. I always tell people, if you can't tell which is top or bottom, plant it on its side, and it will come up. Better than planting it upside down. But with just a little study, I think you'll be able to tell which is the upside. And, you know, like I say, should be about 3/4 of an inch of dirt over the top of that. I like sprinkling a little fertilizer in any of the good fertilizer products, Medina, Mushgrow, Nature's Creation, Espoma, any of those dry fertilizers. Just sprinkle it out and kind of work a little bit in. After your bulbs are up or growing, you know, a liquid fertilizer every 2 or 3 weeks. The thing about caladiums, White Christmas, or any of the other good varieties, is left to their own devices, they'll be pretty all summer, and they'll start fading out about late August or September.
Okay.
If you do your part by feeding them, they will just keep getting bigger and fuller and prettier, and they will be gorgeous the day we have that first hard freeze, and they freeze back in the fall. So,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it's just, you can't just plant them and ignore them. If you do that, they'll be pretty for the summer. If you will feed them like you do your other plants, they'll be pretty for about an additional 3 months.
All right. And again, you tell me how many inches deep to go in the dirt?
About 3/4 of an inch.
That's
about
it.
About the,
and I cover the whole thing?
Yes, cover the whole thing. About as big as the last joint on your index finger. That's about how deep down you want them to be.
Oh, well, now you know what I'm doing today. Thank you.
But it'll be a happy Mother's Day project. And keep them moist, but don't drown them. Water them thoroughly, but don't water again until the surface of that soil is good and dry. If you keep them too wet, they won't do well. So water thoroughly when you water, but then let them get moderately dry. Once they're sprouted and growing, you're all set and off to a good start.
Well, then, if we're going to start getting thunderstorms again on Tuesday, should I wait?
No. The weathermen are into this pattern of using their models, and they're, every time there's the slightest chance of rain, I think we're going to hear there's a chance of rain every week for the next 10 weeks. So I would go ahead and plant them and take your chances. The chance of having it stay soggy wet for an extended period rarely happens in South Texas as we get closer to summer. If you're in Houston, I'd give you another piece of advice, and I'd tell you to move. But here in this area, your caladium should do beautifully for you, Sandy.
Thank you so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, back to gardening on a beautiful Mother's Day morning, and another happy Mother's Day to one of our ladies. Good morning, fellas.
Yes, good morning. I'm looking for a eucalyptus. Do you know where I could find some?
I know we have them at Shades of Green. I suspect they have them at probably at Fanix, probably at Rainbow Gardens. I don't think you're likely to find it in the grocery store, but most good nurseries should have access to them. Now, realize there are several hundred different kinds of eucalyptus. The kind we have and the one that's most commonly grown is the one they call Silver Dollar, that has a kind of roundish leaf with a stem that goes right through the middle of it. It's not something you're going to plant in your yard. If you lived in Houston, maybe so, but it really doesn't like our soil, so you can grow it in a pot, you can grow it in a hanging basket, but wants half-day sun. It's a fun plant to grow and highly aromatic, as you almost certainly know, but they're available there. I think we've got them in 4-inch pots and gallon containers. I imagine most other nurseries are the same.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I have heard that if you hang eucalyptus in your shower, then it helps with congestion and coughing and all sorts of things.
Well, you know, they put it in all these rubs you put on your chest and all these air fresheners and things like that. I think it depends on the individual, but it's certainly not going to hurt you. Now, I will tell you, and you might check around, if you can find just cut eucalyptus, it's going to be, growing your own is going to be a challenge to have enough of it. But call Pat down at Travis Wholesale Florist sometime and ask him if he's got the cut branches. Might save you a lot of time and trouble. I mean, I'd love to sell you a eucalyptus plant. It's kind of fun. But if you're really going after it for medicinal purposes, you might find it easier to buy the cut product. I'd also suggest, now they're closed today, but these two health stores in San Antonio called Rhonda's Nature's Way. Rhonda and her family know more about this stuff than anybody I've ever known in my life. You might call Rhonda and ask her if she has it like in an aerosol form or a little spray bottle or something like that, that would accomplish the same thing with a lot less trouble. I love eucalyptus. If you go to California, you won't see, well, you see this particular kind growing as a shrub, but they have other forms of the eucalyptus that make a tree 150 feet tall. So it's a really, really interesting plant, and I'd encourage you to grow it. But if you're looking for something to help with congestion, there may be a little bit easier ways to get your eucalyptus oil.
Yeah. Do you know of any place in New Braunfels?
I don't know New Braunfels as well. If you've got a health food store up there, you might give them a call and see.
Okay.
That would be your best bet to find the oil. And you can check the plant house up there. I'm not sure if Weston has eucalyptus, but he probably would. But when you come into San Antonio sometime, I know you'll find it. Like I say, if you're looking for the big long branches of it, a lot of florists use it in making arrangements and things. That's why you'll find it somewhere like Travis Wholesale. And they sell to the public. They're not just strictly to the trade.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
And good luck with that. It's fun stuff. And happy Mother's Day. Thank you. Yeah, it's actually a fairly good mosquito repellent, too. We like a product called Murphy's Natural that's a mixture of lemon oil and eucalyptus, and it's a very effective anti-mosquito spray, and, of course, it's free of DEET and all the bad stuff. Let's get the phone lines. It's James, Rosemary, and Chris, and that other line's already layering in. So first up is James. Good morning, James.
How you doing, Bob?
I'm great, sir. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. Beautiful day. You hear me okay?
I hear you perfectly.
Okay, I got your speakerphone. I heard you earlier talking to someone about some mosquitoes.
Right.
I talked to you yesterday, but I have a few more questions. I'll try to make it quick.
Okay.
You told me crepe myrtle. I got that root exposed now.
Okay, that has nothing to do with mosquitoes, but
No, but I have a list here.
Okay. Anyway, you've got the roots exposed.
To expose that root on the crepe myrtle.
Uh-huh.
And I got that done.
Good.
I got lemongrass. I've been told that that's a mosquito repellent.
It is, but it's not so strong. You know, you can't just put one pot of lemongrass on your patio and think you're not going to have any mosquitoes. But, lemongrass oil is very good at mosquito repellent. Lemongrass, of course, is used in a lot of Asian cooking. A lot of Thai food has a lot of lemongrass in it. So there are lots of reasons to grow lemongrass. And if you have enough of it, it's going to have some mosquito repelling effect.
Well, I got about 6 or 7 of them planted around in my yard. So maybe it'll help a little bit.
Hope so.
The other question is, I made the mistake of telling my neighbor that I have blackberries, and she's been over there picking a couple bowls of them, and I'm wondering if they reproduce. Is that a dumb question?
Well, no, sir. It's not a dumb question at all. But blackberries, physiologically, they decide sometime in the winter how many blooms are going to produce, and they're not going to go on producing all summer. Basically, they flower and produce berries they flower for 2 or 3 weeks, and then the berries may ripen over 3 or 4 weeks' time. But the spring season, late spring, is the only time early summer that you're going to get berries from your blackberries. So don't share them all. Don't let them all get away, because once you've gotten through picking over the next week or two, you're going to wait till next year for the next crop.
Oh, okay, sir. Okay.
Now, here's one other thing.
I'm having a hard time getting trumpet vines going.
Oh, man. Maybe that's a good thing, because most people are trying to kill them out. Trumpet vine wants a lot of sun. It wants a lot of water to get established. I would recommend planting it in a bed that is contained where it can't escape, because it's worse than bamboo about putting underground runners out and coming up all over the yard. But get the basic old orange form, planted where it gets plenty of sun, water it regularly to get it started, and then you'll spend the next 10 years trying to get rid of it.
I am having a hard time getting them started by the seed.
No, they don't grow well from seed. You need to take some cuttings, or you need to find somebody selling them and buy a little plant. Very hard to get the seed started. Your cuttings root pretty easily if you know anybody that has a vine. In fact, anybody that has it probably has suckers coming up around their yard, and they would welcome you to dig up some of these little plants that are coming up where they don't want them. But trumpet vine's not a good plant to plant from seed.
Because I've been trying to get them started with seed, and I just can't get them going.
No, that's not going to work.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Bob, and have a good day.
You do the same, James. Thank you, sir. Rosemary is next. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Bob. I have one question. I am wanting to start some new cuttings or new plants of my bay laurel.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if you could tell me the best way to go about that, whether the new growth on top or try to get some from the bottom that's trying to spread out.
Well,
trim down.
You want to get the mature wood. It doesn't matter what part of the plant it comes from, but you don't want that real soft, succulent new growth. You want it to be fairly firm, fairly hard, and then it doesn't really matter where you take it from the plant. Now, bay laurel is something of a challenge to get to root. Even the best growers out there, probably only 1 out of 3 cuttings root. So take a bunch of cuttings, root them in perlite, the white volcanic material. Keep them moist, keep them bright, but no direct sun, and at least some of them will root for you. Now, let me tell you an easier way if you have a big bay laurel plant. Have you ever heard of what they call an air layer? This is where you go out on an existing stem of your bay laurel. You gouge a little piece of bark off the side of the trunk. You don't cut all the way through, but you just peel a little, maybe 2-inch-long area. You cut some of the bark off of that. Then you take a handful, and literally just a handful of moist sphagnum moss, the same kind of long-fibered sphagnum we use to line hanging baskets. You wrap that around this little cut that you made on the side of the limb, and then you wrap that whole thing up with either plastic wrap or aluminum foil. And the plant starts putting roots, the bay laurel starts putting roots down into that wad of sphagnum moss. After about 6 weeks, you can peel it back, be sure it's got some roots started, and then you just snip it off, peel the foil or the plastic off, and plant it up. It's sort of a way that your roots are cutting before you ever take it off of the mother plant.
Yes.
So
yes, I'm going to try both of those. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and you should be, you know, bay laurel makes a big plant. If you've got a good-sized plant, you'll have be able to take all the cuttings you like and put half a dozen air layers on there, and both of them will be successful for you. It's just on the cuttings. Even the pros don't get a real high percentage of rooting, so be a little patient with it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that air layer suggestion. Thank you so much, Bob.
You're sure welcome. Happy Mother's Day. All right, it's going to be Chris and Jerry and Cosette and one open line. Grab it if you like while I say good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm great. Hope you're doing as well this Mother's Day morning.
Doing good. It's a beautiful morning.
Yes, it
is. Mother's Day. Okay, so first question, how to store onions?
Store onions somewhere cool and dry. I happen to store them in my laundry room, which is out of my barn, because they are do have a little odor to them, shall we say, but they don't need refrigeration. You just don't want to put them out in a storage shed where it's 110 degrees in the summer. If it's room temperature or close to it, your onions will do fine. Now, the high sugar onions, like the Sweet 100s, or they call them Texas Super Sweets, 10-15s, lots of different names. They do not keep as long as the other varieties do, but so enjoy those first. But just anywhere cool and dry, and have them spread out one layer thick. I use stackable plastic trays so that I can, you know, not take up a whole lot of floor space, but you can't, like, put them in a bucket or in a bin or anything like that. They've got to be spread out just one layer thick so they have good air circulation around them.
Okay, and that goes for the red onions also?
The red onions will last much longer. The yellow onions will last much longer. If they are not the super sweets, the white onions will last much longer. You can keep those things stored for 8 to 10 months without any problem. It's just my experience with the Sweet 100s, but the 10-19s, the Texas super sweets, they start deteriorating after 2 to 3 months. So they store for a while, but don't keep as long.
Okay. All right, how about beets? Can you store those, or you need to cook them right away?
You need to use them. Now, beets can be pickled and stored for a long period of time, and it's pretty easy to do. If you ever get into canning and pickling, you need to send off for a book. The University of Georgia is called So Easy to Preserve. I think it's around $12 or $15. It's a kind of a plastic spiral bound, about 500 pages of everything you need to know about virtually anything you want to preserve, whether it's from the store or out of your garden. But beets keep fresh for a few days, but you can keep them for a couple of years if you go ahead and pickle them.
And who writes the book again?
It's the Extension Service at the, I believe it's the University of Georgia. Google the book name. It is So Easy to Preserve. I don't think it's available in any of the bookstores, but, it's just my Bible when it comes to knowing how to freeze, to can, to pickle. And it's got a lot of good recipes in there, too. It's a book. It won't cost you much money. It makes a great Christmas gift or Mother's Day gift or any kind of gift if you have friends that enjoy doing that sort of thing.
All right, cool. Okay, and over Easter, there was tulips.
Yes.
You know. So how do you store the bulbs?
Well, the thing about a bulb uses up 80% of it, at least it's stored energy when it comes up in flowers. You have to leave those bulbs growing for 2 or 3 or 4 months after they finish flowering, because this is the time the bulb stores the energy back into the bulb so they can grow and flower again. If they just dry out after they flowered, you're wasting your time to try to store them. If you keep them happy, if you keep them growing, if you keep them good for 6 or 8 weeks or 10 weeks afterwards, then what you can do is the foliage dies down, just dig the bulbs, store them about like you do your onions. Just keep them cool and dry, and you can replant them again in the fall. But if they don't have that couple of months of good growing after they flowered, you're kind of wasting your time.
All right, yeah, I'm way past that.
So. Okay, they're cheap. If you like tulips, they don't give you a lot of bang for the buck, but there's nothing quite like a tulip, so just get some fresh bulbs next year.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thanks for the call.